Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, are you feeling a little OCD lately? Or maybe you blame losing your car keys every day on ADHD. You know, many TV shows are often built, they often build funny characters, quirky characters around people with compulsions and disorders such as ADHD. But if you have that disorder yourself, it's definitely no laughing matter. OCD affects approximately 6 to 9 million Americans. It strikes about 1 in 40 adults and 1 in 100 children. And it's the fourth most common psychiatric diagnosis in the USA, which really surprised me. We'll be talking more about OCD with licensed professional clinical counselor Rhonda Martin at 12:30. And she'll also share how you might channel some of those tendencies for success. But first, I know many parents who find it difficult to cope with their teenagers, and I know equally as many teenagers who find it difficult to cope with their parents. They both claim there's a disconnect there, and ADHD is often blamed for at least some of that disconnect. But my first guest says don't jump to conclusions because there are a lot of myths around ADHD. Joining us now is board-certified family psychologist Dr. Wes Crenshaw, who has real-life go-to advice for teenagers and parents. And Dr. Wes has 19 years of clinical experience as a child psychologist. For the last 8 years, he's co-authored the Double Take Advice column for teenagers and their parents in the Lawrence Journal World. And his new books are Dear Dr. Wes, Real-Life Advice for Teens, and Dear Dr. Wes, Real-Life Advice for Parents of Teens. Dr. Wes Crenshaw, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, Vicki.
Well, I know many people, as I said, who literally parents who want to tear their hair out when they're around teenagers. Well, when their kids hit a certain age, with certain of my friends, it seemed that when their girls hit 15, that was the magic number for them. But what was it about teenagers that made you want to focus your work around them?
Well, I've got one of those 15-year-olds myself right now, but I've had a lot of practice since before she was born getting ready for this moment, so it's probably a little different for me. I originally, interestingly enough, was in radio. I was an on-air personality in Wichita, Kansas, and did late nights, so I got a lot of phone calls from teenagers. Teenagers actually listened to the radio back in those days because they didn't have iPods, and I was always kind of dismayed and intrigued to realize that a lot of those kids didn't have anyone else to talk to but the DJ at the radio station, which was probably not the best person to call when you were in despair. But I, over the years, began to collect little senior pictures and invitations to graduations with people who had very heartfelt messages of how much they appreciated that I had been there on a hard night of their life. And I thought, that's not really a job for a radio announcer, but it might be a pretty good job for me. So I went back to graduate school and have specialized in family psychology, especially treating teenagers for the 20 years hence.
Now, the two books that I just mentioned, they're both called Dear Dr. Wes. One is Real Life Advice for Parents of Teens, and then the other one is focused for the teenagers. But they're based on your columns from the Double Take columns. Talk to us a little bit about why you put this together and how you put it together.
Well, we began the column back in 2004, and it's very unique that we have in print, right next to my advice, an equal amount of advice from a different teenager every year. They submit essays and do interviews for a contest and win a scholarship to write for college that then they write for a year for the column in either their junior or senior year of high school. So we've had 8 co-authors, and therefore half the material in both of the books is written by a person who was at the time a teenager in high school, and I think they have sometimes better advice than I do, but makes it a very unique manual for parenting.
Yeah, and I actually like this book because obviously I get sent a lot of books, but I liked the way you put this together because it's very simple has a very simple and quick, easy approach to find the information you're looking for, which, let's face it, if you're busy with teenagers, you don't have time to sit down and read manuals on this stuff.
Exactly. We did that very intentionally.
Yes. So I want to jump in and I want to talk about ADHD because this is something that I see. I don't have children myself, but I hear friends all the time saying, you know, their kids being diagnosed with ADHD or they don't know what's going on with them. I wonder if they've got ADHD, but there are an incredible amount of myths around this. So let's just dive right in here and let's talk about what ADHD is, because I do think that we think of it sometimes as something it's not.
Yeah, the core element of ADHD is not hyperactivity. That's one of the myths. It's inattention. And for some subset of kids with that inattention problem, which comes from a problem in the frontal lobe of the brain, some of those kids cannot even inhibit their ability to jump up and move around. That's the hyperactive kids, but they are actually the minority. The majority of people who are properly diagnosed with ADHD are those of the inattentive type, and it makes it very difficult to do a lot of life tasks that we take for granted. And it's not that we don't have some of the same problems, the non-ADD people. It's that we're more tolerant a lot of times of getting through those problems. So everybody who's been in high school or college has had to read a boring book and didn't like it. For you and I, we can get through that. We can struggle through it and just be annoyed. For an ADHD person, it's just an insurmountable task. They cannot stay focused well enough to drag themselves through that boring activity. And there are, you know, hundreds of other examples of that in daily life that make that difficult for them.
Right. Now, I've read that ADHD tends to run in families, but the cause isn't really known. What do you have to say on that?
That's absolutely correct. You can predict ADHD transmission genetically at about the same rate you can predict someone's height, and that's fairly high concordance.
Wow.
So it does appear to be inherited, and it will skip a generation on occasion, but you can usually look back and find the people up a few generations that have some of those symptoms.
So if I'm a parent, or, you know, the other thing I want to talk about in a little while is adults who are diagnosed, you know, midlife
yes.
with ADHD. But so if I have a child who is, you said that the biggest thing is that they're not paying attention, they can't focus, trouble sitting still and then acting before thinking. But, you know, a lot of that is just normal kid behavior. So how do we differentiate between normal kid behavior, somebody who's a bit more boisterous than usual, and somebody who's got ADHD?
Yeah, it's a great question, and there is a very viable answer. One of the myths about ADHD is that it's overdiagnosed, and that's not actually true. There's quite a few people that are not diagnosed, and some of us think it may be underdiagnosed. However, it is not a myth that ADHD is often misdiagnosed. And so there are people who have not gone through a sufficient testing to find out if they do or don't have ADHD. It's not something, even though those of us who do it a lot can kind of eyeball it, I can pick them out of a classroom. A lot of people who don't do that, physicians, general practitioners who really aren't out working with that population, have a lot harder time. And so they rely on reports from the patient that may or may not be accurate. So where that all leads us is that there are standardized tests, and standardized in our business means you compare them to a norm group of people known not to have ADHD. And so the only people who should be getting diagnosed are the people who reach at what's called a 70th percentile, so that everyone who took the test, 70% of the people scored lower than they did. Those are the people who stand out in the crowd.
Well, that's interesting, and that's a good myth to bust then, because I've often heard and read that ADHD is often misdiagnosed and overdiagnosed.
The over is not true. Misdiagnosed, I think, very much is true. I've worked with people who, you know, went in and talked about some symptoms, and for example, sleep deprivation will lead to symptoms similar to ADHD. Certain kinds of anxiety will make people appear to be ADHD. And so we've kind of undiagnosed a few people, but a lot of times we're seeing people who haven't been taken through the correct testing. And believe you me, the testing is not very difficult or expensive. It isn't that complicated.
Now, is this a myth or is this true? Boys are diagnosed with ADHD more often than girls.
You know, that may have been true at one point, because that was in the day in the late 80s and up to the mid-90s where frequently the entry point for a diagnosis was hyperactive behavior. And boys, by far, are the more likely to be diagnosed as hyperactive. Girls will be more likely to be diagnosed as inattentive only. And so if you're not a big red flag in the middle of the classroom, people may not notice and send you for further evaluation.
Interesting. We're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about how it's treated and how it affects adults, too, and how some people can get to midlife without it ever being diagnosed. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Dr. Wes Crenshaw. He specializes in teenage behavior. His book is called Dear Dr. Wes, Real Life Advice for Parents of Teens. And then, of course, he has the one that's specifically for teenagers. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Click the shows page on 1150kknw.com for the scoop on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. We are talking in this segment with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. His new book is called Dear Dr. Wes, Real Life Advice for Parents of Teens. And Dear Dr. Wes, Real Life Advice for Teens. And we are talking about ADHD specifically today. I want to get into technology and how that affects it in a moment and how it also affects adults. But I want to just get back into just following up from our last question and how ADHD is treated, because I've heard there are so many different, you know, I think at one point the tendency was just to throw them on medication, but I've heard there are other ways to treat this now. So talk to us a little bit about that, if you would, please, Dr. Wes.
Well, I keep my continuing education on ADHD up to date because of the amount of work I do. And so I usually attend every year the lecture programs at the American Psychological Association. And both of the APA's psychological and psychiatric and the American Academy of Pediatrics all agree that for a properly diagnosed individual, medication is going to make a tremendous benefit. And we definitely see that. Now, there is a lot more to know about that in terms of how people learn to use medicine. And there are sort of things like learning to take breaks off of the medicine that are critically important that are not always taught. So there's a whole set of lifestyle behaviors that kind of have to be brought into play. Just doing medication alone a lot of times won't quite conquer the problem, but it is usually quite critical.
And what's the most common kind of medicine that they use?
We really have had very few changes in medicines for ADHD over the last 40 or 50 years. There are two classes. One is the Adderall-type medicines, which are amphetamine-based, and the other are the Ritalin-type medicines that are what's called methylphenidate. And the only difference, really, has been in the ways those are packaged. We've gotten some formulations lately that last longer during the day and do not cause quite so many side effects. But I will say that medication, and I'm not a prescriber, but we have prescribers in my clinic, and medication management is always an experiment because each person is different and is going to respond differently to medicine. So one has to be patient. And for the folks with ADHD, patience is not necessarily their best thing. So we have to really coach them to hang in there and work at it.
Right. So tell me how you typically coach somebody and what kind of therapy, like maybe behavioral therapy, you'd use with them to help them through it too.
There is a lot of, it's not so much behavioral therapy in the classic sense where you have a reward and consequence system. Mm-hmm. They don't respond very well to that. But it is in many ways, I always am nervous about using the word coaching because it's been taken on a whole new meaning now in the business. But I still think coaching with a small C is a pretty good term for it. There are just problems that folks with ADD encounter that other people deal with more easily, and trying to see those coming and help them problem solve them in small steps towards a goal is really the core element. I actually, on my website, have a download people can get for free. That's my 14 principles for the ADHD people to live by, and they put those on their phones and stick them on their fridge, and they're pretty handy.
Right. So share a couple of those with us, if you would, a couple of the principles.
At the top of the list is take personal responsibility. Another one is when things are going downhill, don't make them worse. If you don't know how to work something, leave it alone, and that includes your relationship. If you don't know how to work it, you probably shouldn't try. You should probably figure out how to do it first. Those kinds of things.
Okay, and listeners can, as you said, download that off your website if they want to get all of the list.
Yep, that's a free bonus.
So. Great. And I want to ask you about technology because, you know, we all joke where I work with various groups of people, technology has made me ADHD because people are multitasking. They're on the phone while they're emailing and they might be texting on a whole different phone at the same time and they're reading email on their laptop. So has technology made us more prone to that?
I'll tell you how this works. The real ADHD is a neurological impairment. I think we are creating a sort of acquired version mm-hmm. of ADHD. My daughter likes me to watch the TV show Glee with her, and I think it's a pretty good show, and it's a good show for parents to spend time talking to their kids about different issues they bring up in there. But the hardest thing for me about that show, particularly in its last two seasons, is it's edited in such short form in some of the scenes that I almost can't handle it. And that is I think, directed towards a shorter attention span. They change scenes quickly, they move mm-hmm. quickly, and I think this is reflected in a lot of media nowadays. We've gotten into sort of a Twitter-sized attention span, but it isn't that it really induces ADD. I think it is more of acquired. Our lives are becoming kind of ADD and kind of manic, too.
Right. So let's talk a little about adults, and because, you know, I know a couple of people who were diagnosed in midlife with ADHD, and they said, well, now that explains a lot. How can somebody go undiagnosed for so long?
Well, and just to affirm what they'd said, one of the most gratifying things in this business is getting someone correctly diagnosed and treated, and they will almost invariably say, my God, I didn't know this is how normal people thought, how they were able to function. So I know what they're talking about. The way people escape detection is very simply that only in the last 15 to 20 years, as our society shifted away from models of work and school that allowed ADHD people to function more adequately. We've moved now into a technological era where math and science are overemphasized, I think, sometimes, and good, solid vocational and manual tasks are pushed aside. And when you are requiring everybody to take calculus, you're going to start detecting the ADHD people. That wasn't a requirement when I was in high school. I don't know about you. But when you're putting people through the most rigorous, complex thinking tasks that we have as a routine, you're going to pick up a whole lot more people who cannot do that kind of work.
Interesting. That is interesting.
Yeah.
So when people say, why the heck do I have to do calculus? That's a very valid reason there in one way.
Well, I am terribly biased about this. I'll be the first to admit, but I believe that probably all of the Supreme Court justices that are weighing these important decisions this week probably can't do calculus either. I'm not sure they're required to do that on a daily basis, and I think we've gotten a little too caught up in the idea that somehow math and science can save us all. I think they're great. My wife's a science teacher, and I think that's a fine thing, but I see a whole lot of kids who are not going to be needing to use that level of learning in their future careers. And that's going to pick up a lot of people who just are not able to do that kind of work.
Right, right. So you see a lot of people in your practice. What are, as a parent, what do you see the biggest challenge for parents being if their child has ADHD?
Well, it's really, interestingly, the same challenge I think all parents face, and that is trying not to take things too personally. Parents have a very hard time sometimes taking a step back and understanding that their child was not put on this earth to turn their world into a big hell or something, and their child is not here as a reflection of who they are as a person. And for the kids, the folks that have ADHD kids, that's even harder because they struggle, and they struggle sometimes socially. They struggle with their self-esteem, and they struggle, obviously, in school and work. And parents sometimes really have a hard time by feeling like it's their fault or feeling like it's the kid's fault. People routinely who have ADHD, every one of them has been called lazy. And so parents struggle to just take a step back and realize this is a real neurological problem, and it's one we can treat, and let's all just sit down and be calm.
Right. Now, I know that you say that you everything you need to know about parenting regular, teenagers, regardless of whether they have ADHD or not, can be summed up in one word. What is that one word?
That word is influence. People believe too often that when their kid hits 13 or 14, much as you were describing at the opening, that they've sort of lost their chance. And the research is very clear that kids will turn out more like their parents than they will the peer group. And parents have to believe in their own influence and exert that influence, not in a controlling way, but in a guiding way, really well into kids' 20s, they remain very influential. Mm-hmm. And so people have to really seize that and believe in it. And once they do, then they see that they have quite a number of chances to continue to guide their child in these years.
Right. And since you also see so many teenagers, so many kids with ADHD, what do you see as being their biggest challenge? Because I'm sure it's difficult for them to have this, there's always some kind of tag attached to these, to names that we give things.
Well, and it's true. I think the real challenge for most kids, once they find out what they have, especially if they're preteens, they're really able to adapt to that better. It's harder when you find out as a late teen or in college to make that adaptation and change the personality parts that you can change. But I think the biggest challenge is, well, the one thing you'll see on neurological exams for the ADHD people is that they have a trouble planning. And that's the greatest challenge, is to get the kids to get a plan together and then to stick to and run the plan. I'm working on a book about ADHD, and I'm going to call it I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not. And that pretty well describes exactly how they feel. And so finishing a plan when you always want to be somewhere else, doing something else, and you get there and then you want to be doing something else, is pretty difficult.
Well, it sounds like great advice, certainly great advice in this book, and you've shared some more with us today on ADHD specifically. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Dr. Wes?
Well, I want to make sure they have that website so they can keep track of what we're doing, and that is drwes.com, and there's a hyphen between Dr. and Wes, so it's dr-wes.com. If you don't put the hyphen in there, you're going to get a really great high-fiber diet from the other Dr. Wes. And that's not me. I know nothing about fiber except I should eat it.
Eat more. There you go. So the website, again, is dr-wes.com. Dr. Wes Crenshaw, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was great.
And again, Dr. Wes's book is called Dear Dr. Wes, Real Life Advice for Parents of Teens, and also Real Life Advice for Teens Themselves. Two different books out there, and they're both really good. Please do stay with us when we come back. We're going to be talking with Rhonda Martin about OCD. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN!
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicki at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Don't touch that dial. You might miss something life-changing. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we're talking in this segment about OCD. OCD afflicts approximately 6 to 9 million Americans, strikes about 1 in 40 adults, 1 in 100 children, and is the fourth most common psychiatric diagnosis in the U.S. And according to the World Health Organization, it ranks among the 10 leading causes of disability worldwide. So pretty significant. My guest in this segment is called Rhonda Martin. She's been in private practice with the Akron Family Institute in Akron, Ohio for 12 years. She's a licensed professional clinical counselor, board certified professional counselor and diplomat in pediatric anxiety disorders. Rhonda Martin has been on numerous media channels. She was featured at the 2011 New York City Book Expo for her book about children with OCD. And that book was called Stuck, a children's book about OCD. And she also received the prestigious Mom Choice Award for juvenile books in 2011. Rhonda Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Vicki.
Well, I'm most interested in what gets people doing the work they're doing. So what about OCD in particular? I know you do all kinds of work, but OCD is big with you. What was it about obsessive compulsive disorder that drove you to do more work in this area?
Well, what drove me to do the most work in this area is that I find that once we have the right diagnosis, the results are incredible for treatment with cognitive behavioral therapy. And in this line of work, most people go into it because they want to help others, and certainly that's the reason I went into the field, and I saw such great results and potential in treating, especially the early onset cases of OCD.
Okay. And I read, we're going to talk about what it's not. I read that it's not, OCD is not obsessed stalkers and fans, workaholics, compulsive liars, compulsive shoppers, gamblers, or those with fear of heights or flying, etc. So what is OCD?
OCD is a tendency to get stuck on something and not be able to attend to what else is going on in the environment. And you could be stuck on something going on in the mind. For example, some people get stuck on certain numbers. They get stuck on certain words. And you could also get stuck on different things going on in the environment, individuals that may walk down a sidewalk and not want to touch the crack, so they avoid it in fear that something really bad may happen. So some of the elements of OCD for all individuals are just, one, getting stuck, and two, believing that whatever it is that they're trying to avoid doing will cause some tremendously terrible event to happen in their life. And for children, it's often the death of a parent that they fear. And in adolescence, it generally has something to do with their appearance or even their own health or well-being. And in adults, it often has to do with the safety and health of our own children.
Interesting. And it's just like ADHD, it's an actual neurological disorder, correct?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And does the fact that, you know, people with OCD, they go through these compulsions and through these rituals, and it provides them temporary relief, does that fact increase the cycle because they got relief and then, you know, does it gradually get worse and worse, or does it tend to stay at a certain level?
Well, and there's sort of two questions in there, and they're both great ones. The first one is that since it does provide relief, that is a reward. So the next time they start to get that discomfort again, they will go back and start doing the compulsions to relieve it. So just that built-in reward system. And then the question about if it continues to get worse, or what then is the outcome? That's really dependent on a lot to do with genetics. One, we tend to look at family history to find out if it's going to be moderate or severe case or just mild. So we're going to look back through mom, dad, aunts, grandparents, and see genetically if there are a lot of individuals in the family that have OCD, it's probably going to be a more moderate or severe case. If we can't find a whole lot of it, just a few tendencies tracking here and there in the family history, then genetically it may be a little bit more lightly loaded, if you will. So the severity of it, whether it's mild, moderate, or severe, is going to have a lot to do with the genetic piece of it.
Okay. Now, I've read that people with OCD realize that their obsessions are irrational, but they just can't help themselves and think the only way to relieve it is to keep doing those.
Exactly. And most of these individuals, the rest of their life, the other things that they think about and do are very rational and very normal for them. They understand it. And that's why this disorder is so painful for individuals that have OCD, because they know that the parts of their life that have to do with the OCD are so irrational. And they know that this wouldn't be acceptable to them in the other parts of their life.
Mm. I read that there's actually no lab test for OCD. Is that still true?
That's still true.
So how do you diagnose then?
Well, we diagnose it by having an individual come in and just asking a series of questions of what goes on in their daily life. And we try to determine based on how much of their time each day is spent doing obsessions or compulsions or both. And then we determine, do we want to have a diagnosis of it? And then if so, is it mild, moderate, or severe?
Mm-hmm. And what other kind of disorders are common with that? I read that like major depression, anxiety disorders, eating disorders are all very common with that. What else?
Vicki, that's exactly right. And what we usually find, if there is a primary diagnosis of obsessive-compulsive disorder, generally there's going to be at least symptoms or traits of a few others. And depression seems to be one of the more common ones, generalized anxiety disorder, a body dysmorphic disorder, a panic disorder, agoraphobia, specific phobias. So they tend to be comorbid with other anxiety issues or depression.
Mm-hmm. So when you, is there a lot of shame around this when you work with people? Because, you know, people are often embarrassed to talk about their disorders.
Yes, and that is so important and so perceptive of you to know that. That is really the one trait that almost every patient has when they come in is shame. And even the family members have some shame generally too, because when they come in, this has been a secret. And if it's a child who has it, it's been a secret that they might have told parts of it to their family, but there's still at least half of it generally is still a secret. So it seems so illogical to them what's going on in their mind, and that maybe they have to take 4 steps forward and then 3 backward and then 2 forward and then hear a word said a certain way and then walk over and not step on a crack and then do what they're going to do and walk through a doorway. I mean, to them, there's so much shame attached to this where they know this is all irrational and they're embarrassed. And again, most of it, they don't share with anyone.
Right. Interesting. Now, I want to look at a couple of myths, myth versus fact here. And one of the myths is that stress causes OCD and people just need to relax. I've read that it can trigger the onset of obsessions, but it's not the cause. Is that correct?
That is correct. And what it is that the cause is definitely genetic, but the onset of when it develops can have something to do with if there is a trauma or some severe stress, or if an individual has a bad condition with strep throat. If they've had just strep throat and it's been real severe, that can actually trigger the onset of the original OCD symptoms in a person.
Oh, wow.
And then after they have the initial onset, the symptoms, whether they wax or wane or whether they're mild or moderate or severe, does have a lot to do with the body's perception of stress.
Is there a particular age when it's typically comes on? Is it more common in children, more common in adult life?
Well, most, for boys, you'll see a little bit more of them that will get it when they're younger. For girls, it's a little bit later. And what we do know about the earlier onset cases of OCD is that those do tend to be the more serious cases. So that if an individual just maybe has some quirks and they're in their 20s or 30s or 40s and they're concerned if they're going to develop OCD, it's probably not going to be a severe case that they develop if they do. However, if a young child has the symptoms, and let's say they did have strep throat, and they didn't get an antibiotic for it right away, and they come down with it, they are more likely to have a severe or a moderate to severe case than a mild case of it.
Mm-hmm. One of the most common myths I saw when I was researching across the internet, and I know we've already touched on this, but I think it's worth repeating, is that people are just quirky. You know, people have their little quirks.
Yeah.
And there are so many television shows now. You know, Monk, for example, it springs to mind, where the detective there has OCD and it's very funny. But, of course, it's not at all funny to those actually living it. So it's nothing to do with personality, nothing to do with willpower.
Yes, and the show Monk actually is fairly accurate in its presentation of OCD. And just as much as Monk gets stuck in there and on what types of things from his watery drinks and down the line, I mean, certainly those are the types of things individuals do struggle with that have OCD. So the quirks, but we do need to separate out quirks from a pattern of these kind of obsessions and compulsions. It's possible to have just one or two things that you do that people would consider to be quirky. For example, some individuals will have their clothing lined up in their closet by color, and if something gets out of order, they're upset. So, and some would say, hey, that's quirky. And others may have other tendencies. For example, one person leaves at 7 till the hour to go to work. Not if they're ready at 11 till, they wait till 7 till because they feel like it will be a lucky day if they leave at 7 till. So I think most people have at least a few quirks that they can say, you know, are maybe a little different from other people. But what we're looking for is the level of discomfort. When an individual has so many quirks and they're obsessive compulsive tendencies are so severe that they are uncomfortable and they're making the people in their family and just others around them uncomfortable. That's when we want to seek treatment.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break in just a moment. And when we come back, I want to talk about, you know, some of the treatment methods that are out there. And I want to just talk a little bit about your book, because you mentioned, you know, we get stuck in this pattern, and your book is called Stuck, appropriately enough. Tell us a little bit about the book and why you wrote that book.
Well, with stuck, that's exactly what happens in the brain. Those that have anxiety disorders, especially OCD, don't have enough serotonin available to act as a lubricant to keep thoughts and actions flowing through their mind the way that they were intended to flow through. So because of that, their thoughts and their actions get stuck on words, places, things, events, and they can't move on, and they get extremely frustrated. So stuck just reveals in the life of the character in the book, Cinnamon, all the different ways that she's stuck every day in her life.
And it's a very cool book, and it is for young children.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about treatment of OCD, what kind of options are out there, and maybe some tips for parents and those suffering with OCD. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Rhonda Martin. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick & Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150. Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
1150kknw.com. It's why they invented the internet. We think. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. We are talking in this segment with Rhonda Martin. She's a licensed professional clinical counselor and board-certified professional counselor, and specializes in OCD. And she has a book out called Stuck, a children's book about OCD, which is really cool. It's an illustrated book. I wanted to talk in this segment about treatment for OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. Rhonda, some of the things that I saw as possible treatments were cognitive behavioral therapy, exposure and response prevention, and medication. So talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Absolutely. Vicki, the most important piece in determining what the best treatment is going to be for an individual is to have an evaluation and know whether it's mild, moderate, or severe OCD, and if there is a lot of insight or if there's poor insight. So most of the time in the severe cases, we will see that there's little insight. The person is able to know that they have OCD, but they can't recognize what parts of their day are OCD and which are not. So we'll start with the more moderate to severe cases. That is when we would want to consider a combination of both the medication and the exposure therapy. And what we would do is medication would generally start in about 4 weeks after, and you would have a baseline of how the individual's doing. But then about 4 weeks into it, after the SSRI, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, after that starts to work and really get a good supply of serotonin in the brain so that the person can become stuck less often, we would then do exposure. And we would go through a list of what are some of the times and issues that the person has the most difficulty with and when they get stuck the most. We would work up the line and we would get it to a point that they have some flooding where they have a whole lot of experience with those things that they fear, even if they believe that those things are going to result in something terrible happening. We're there with them. We work through it with them. And because there have been about 4 weeks for that SSRI to get in their system, it does help them feel a little less anxiety and a little more confident and able to do that cognitive behavioral part of the process. So those are the pieces with the more moderate to severe cases. However, when we're talking about mild, mild is where we're going to have a lot of contact with people that we work with, and kids are going to be pretty much just appear normal at school if they just have mild. We need to know ways and strategies to work with mild OCD, and most of the time we do not do any medication with it, and we sometimes will do some cognitive behavioral work, but our first step is just going to be going through some lifestyle issues and making certain that we have the child the healthiest that they can be. And a few of those things, I call them on my website the 10 S's for dealing with OCD. They're just strategies that work very well, and there's a lot of research behind them as well. And one of the ways for treating mild OCD is making sure that a person is involved in some sports, some kind of cardiovascular working out, generally 3 to 5 times a week for 30 to 40 minutes. Interval workouts are best. So the boot camps and those kind of programs that YMCA and fitness clubs offer are really excellent.
Why do they work the best?
They work the best because what happens is a person who has anxiety, they are going to, their heart rate's going to get fast. They're going to get really stressed out when they start to see the crack in the sidewalk or things that are going to happen through their day that make their heart rate change, make their sweating rate change, and just affect them physically. And what happens when you do interval workouts, for example, if a person did 10 minutes of running and then a 30-minute, 1-minute interval, 30 different exercises, and then followed up with 10 minutes of running. What would happen is they would so toughen up their system, and they would make it so that it was more difficult because their heart has been exercised up, down, stop, then a slower routine, then a faster one. It actually helps them so that when they have these stimuli or triggers to their anxiety, it doesn't really take effect for about 4 hours after they exercise.
Ooh, so
it's great. And then other than sports, the other two that I think out of the 10 that are really powerful, one is sleeping. A lot of individuals that have anxiety do require a bit more sleep than other individuals do. So we want to make sure that they're getting adequate sleep and that before they go to bed at night, about 15 minutes before bedtime, all individuals with anxiety need to take a shower, relatively warm shower. When they get out, their body temperature will drop about a fourth of a degree, which in turn, if they go to bed within 15 minutes, will make them go into the level 3 and 4 deeper sleep faster. And this is necessary in order to rejuvenate the mind through sleep so that the person can have the strongest brain for dealing with the next 2 days.
Interesting. And these are all the 10 from, you took these from the 10 strategies for
yes.
coping, which are available on your website. Give us an example of another strategy.
Another strategy that's very important is being sugar-free. It's hard to do because those that have anxiety, they crave carbs. They crave white flour carbs and just white sugar because it's a quick fix for getting rid of cortisol, which is what we have in our bodies when we feel stressed. However, long-term, after that initial hour and a half is over, the individual's going to have more anxiety if they eat the white flour carbs and the white sugar. So a lot of the moderate research that we have that has just come out in the past 12 months shows that there is such a correlation between being sugar-free and being anxiety-free. So we must watch what our kids eat, even as school parties are going on with cupcakes and candy and just, you know, suckers and brownies and that type of thing. And all of my patients that I work with anxiety, all of them are on a modified diet.
Right. Interesting. It's so important. And, you know, time after time, we talk about a lot of disorders on the show throughout the course of the year. And serotonin plays up again and again and again. It has to be one of the most important neurotransmitters, I would think.
Yes, it is. You're exactly right.
So I want to talk about OCD at work, because I'm sure we all know somebody, you know, or work with somebody who's got OCD. And, you know, how can we turn that to our advantage in a work situation? Because these people still have to go to work.
Yes. Yes, they do. And actually, they hold the potential of being some of the most successful people because they have mild or moderate OCD. They tend to be organized and planners, and they have an anxiety that's just burning inside of them if things aren't done or if they're not completed correctly. And if they just turn all of that anxiety to where their passion is, where their career is, then they are going to be very successful. And just to look at some different occupations, just starting, for example, with radio interviewing, if an interviewer had some obsessive compulsive tendencies, he or she would be able to connect very well with the individuals they're interviewing, because their brain is going to get stuck on what they're doing, and they're going to be much more intense in what they're doing. So their focus is going to enhance their job performance.
Interesting.
So there's a piece there. And just moving to something maybe really fun as a career, basketball, football, baseball, soccer, ice skating, anything like that. An individual who has OCD, their brain works a lot harder to understand spatial things. And those that have OCD know what I mean by that. For example, if they feel like they have to touch something so many times, they develop such an acute sense of space that whenever they play a sport, they have more control over getting the ball to that space, that desired space. So whether they're throwing a football or kicking a soccer ball or trying to pitch a strike over the home plate, they have the clear advantage over the rest of us.
Interesting. And so if we can just learn to harness that and you know, use it to our advantage, we can definitely make a play on the field there.
Exactly.
Or at work.
Right. And even managers, they tend to have such skill. They can walk into a room, which they might feel this is a disadvantage, but they can walk into a room and look around and see every single thing that's not perfect, that is wrong in the business. And with that, they'll become agitated and maybe at times can be even difficult to work for. However, the clarity of imperfection is so precise in their mind that it can make them very good as a business owner, an entrepreneur, or a manager.
Oh, isn't that interesting? I'm just thinking now of the people, a couple of people I know that are OCD, and I have to say they're amongst also the most intelligent people that I've ever met.
Yeah.
And yes, you're dead on there when you say they can walk into a room and tell you exactly what's wrong.
Yes, and they can. And the intelligence piece that you just mentioned, there's a lot of research that shows that they tend to have slightly higher IQs than normal. So they do tend to be, and of course, natural IQ is going to help, but compound that with their desire for perfection. And we certainly have a disproportionate number of patients that have OCD that have 4.0 grade point averages. Mm-hmm. It's extremely disproportionate. And when I do their checks every 9 weeks with their grades, most of them are 4 point or very close.
Interesting. Well, we just have like 1 minute left. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Rhonda? This has been fascinating.
Well, I would just like to leave them with a website. They can go and find lots of intriguing information that can help either their own children, their family members. And if they just go to www.ocdinkids.com and know that everything that's on that website that's offered to help helps with all of the anxiety disorders. As Vicki, you stated, it has so much to do with serotonin, and all that I present on that website, it's just ways to boost serotonin and to really help individuals have a better quality of life every day.
Right, and in particular, that 10 strategies for coping sounds like a really useful tool for people.
Yes.
Yeah. And just a final quick word for parents who might be tearing their hair out with, if they have a kid with OCD.
Just a quick word of advice would be get an evaluation done and find out if it's mild, moderate, or severe. And if it is on the mild, moderate end, just go on the website and look at these strategies and incorporate them to get some immediate results in the next few weeks. And if it's a moderate or severe, don't be afraid to use the medication. A lot of people just think, oh, no, I don't want my child to take anything, especially since it's hereditary and parents might even have OCD themselves and not want medication. But with regard to that, don't be afraid of that. The SSRIs, especially Zoloft, they're tested so well with children, and they seem to be relatively safe. So take a look at it.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Vicki. Thank you.
And again, you can find out more about Rhonda Martin at OCDinKids.com. You can find out more about her book called Stuck There Too and those 10 strategies. I thank you for being with us this week. If you have questions or comments or feedback on today's show, you can find me at 800-495-7617. 800-495-7617, or you can email at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net. Thanks so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it. Hope you learned as much as I did today, and we'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.